May all beings be happy. May all beings be healthy. May all beings be free from harm. May all beings love life. May all beings awaken. Welcome to another Cuke Audio Podcast. I'm DC Poobah of Cuke Audio and Cuke Archives, preserving the legacy of Shunryu Suzuki and those whose paths crossed his, and anything else that comes to mind. I pray that you and yours are safe and comfortable, free of economic hardship, and able to get out and do whatever it is you want within the limitations of the universal precept of do as little harm as possible. Today we have more pieces from the work in progress, Tassajara Stories. So we're going to start off with one called More People. But first, let's have our pause to meditate. So, when you hear the bell, hit pause if you wish, and meditate or not for as long as you wish. And when you're through, hit unpause. And we'll all come back at the exact same time, and we'll hit the bell, and we'll hear about more people. More People. Maud Oakes was an artist, writer, and ethnologist who specialized in studying the Navajo and a tribe of Mayan descendants in Guatemala, and attempted to fill the gap in that she saw as Americans' ignorance of their Indian heritage. In the summer of 1968, she sat at a table overlooking the creek on the dining room deck, chatting with Shunryu Suzuki and Richard Baker. Three men hovered near them, one with a camera, one with a microphone, and an observer. They were making a film about Tassajara for KQED, the San Francisco Public Broadcasting Station, PBS. Baker. If you choose the inner world, not just dreams, but the whole inner experience, then the outer world would become like the inner world. It would become much more real. Suzuki. Actually, there is no inside or outside. Baker. Yeah, that's how I feel about it. Excuse me. Oakes. But now when you meditate, you go inside, don't you? Suzuki. Not the inside, not outside, just open. Maud Oakes had been a guest at Tassajara when the Becks owned it. In our first year, and again now in our second year there, she commented on how impressed she was with all that we'd accomplished. She was particularly fascinated with the stonework being done in building the new kitchen, how they'd fit the stones and take them out and cement them in. oaks. Then I noticed that girl chipping the rock. Suzuki, oh yes, she's very good. Oaks, that's a lot of work for a girl. Suzuki, yes, excellent. The name of that woman was Audrey Walter. Suzuki explained she was making the cornerstones. He'd been closely following the stonework, especially hers. Oak said she'd always loved stones, that when she was a girl, she'd pick them up wherever she'd go and put them in her bedroom closet till it got so full her mother told her that had to stop. Baker said that when he came back from a stint in the Merchant Marines, he was pleased to find that his college roommates had made sure his big box of prize rocks was not thrown out. He turned toward Suzuki and said, "You're the only person I know it can be said of positively that you have rocks in your head." And here's from a lecture Suzuki gave. As you know, I like stones very much, but especially big ones. Someone came to me the other day with a magnifying glass and said, "Look at those stones." So I looked at them one by one. But to my great astonishment, those small stones were exactly the same as big ones. They were as interesting as the big ones. The shapes were different, and some had very good shapes. You could make a beautiful garden with those stones. I was very pleased. I thought, this is what the universe consists of and how everything is going. So if you cannot accomplish something great, you can work on a very small thing in a very small scale. And the meaning is not any different at all. This is the nature of our practice and teaching. San Francisco Chronicle columnist Charles McCabe came to Tassajara when the Becks owned it. He was a hard-drinking Irishman from Hell's Kitchen in New York City, and booze was a frequent guest in his insightful and satirical columns. He wrote one back then in Beck's Day on Tassajara with a title referring to the baths, "Stand Still and Get Healthy." He asked the Becks what else he could write about, so Bob called Bill Lambert, who came in, and McCabe wrote an article called "The Last of the Great White Hunters." It was just verbatim, right out of Bill's mouth, as they drank and drank the Becks booze together. McCabe said he'd be stupid if he changed anything Lambert said. Many of us read his Fearless Spectator columns whenever a chronicle was left behind by a guest or brought in on a town trip. McCabe himself came in, but we didn't have a bar and he didn't seem comfortable. He looked out of place to me, his city clothes and hat, the pallor of his face. He seemed uncomfortable slouching in a chair out in front of the office in the shade. I'm sure he was eager to get back to his regular haunt, Gino and Carlo Bar in North Beach. He soaked in the men's plunge and left a couple of hours after he arrived. There was an investment counselor who lived in Pebble Beach, a gated scenic community in Monterey. He first came in with Michael Murphy. There was quite a contrast between the two. Michael was calm and composed, and his friend seemed like someone who had too much coffee. Something would always be moving on him, fingers tapping, fidgeting. Both, however, were open and friendly. I was not surprised when he said he had a hard time when he joined us for Zazen. He admired us for being able to sit still that long. I said that from what I'd gathered, the more difficulty one had with sitting still like that, the more one got out of it. The workshops, talks, encounter groups, and atmosphere at Esalen, he said, worked better for him. Legions of people were going through big changes that day, and he was one of them. He said his life had been rotated 180 degrees. He had long been a member of the Baha'i faith and believed that there were many admirable aspects of Baha'i, such as respecting other religions and teaching the equality and oneness of all humanity. But Baha'i was so strict, and now he was living a life that went against much of their moral code: drinking, smoking pot, nude mixed bathing at the Esalen baths, promiscuity. He was a well-known figure in Monterey County. Other guests would recognize him, and some blamed the drastic drop in the value of their portfolios to him losing his bearings due to his love affair with the Esalen scene, rather than the deep recession that the economy was going through. I was a little taken aback when he asked me if he might be able to have one of the younger female students for the night. God. Like a lot of younger people in America, he had found an exhilarating freedom and knew there was no going back to the life he had before and no way to reconcile with Baha'i. But he was a prominent member of the Baha'i faith, the treasurer of the national organization in America. His whole family was involved. His collection of the famous Baha'i artist Mark Toby rivaled any museum. He was tied in so many ways. I sympathized. I always appreciated the libertine life, but I was sure glad I'd found Zen Center, which to a great degree protected me and the world at large from my tendency toward excess. I knew he would level off in time, like a lot of us. Bill Graham was the great entrepreneur of rock for the Bay Area. He owned the Fillmore and Winterland auditoriums, where many of the big-name bands had been playing. He came in as an overnight guest at the urging of friends who told him he needed to slow down and take it easy for a few days. I thanked him for his support with our fundraisers, reminded him how he let me into his show for free when I was passing out flyers for the Zenefit, and thanked him for forgiving a student's debts. I didn't know why the student owed him money, but he'd been doing ironwork in the city to pay Graham back and save up some for a return to Tassajara. So Graham learned about this and canceled the debt. Graham was frustrated at Tassajara, though, because he couldn't see the 49ers football game that was going to happen in a few hours. He drove up to Chew's Ridge to listen to it on the radio and didn't return. Ann Armstrong was a well-known psychic. She and her husband Jim came in as students. They were good friends of Alan Watts and Yvonne, who was an occasional client of Ann's. Yvonne introduced Ann and Jim to Suzuki. At Tassajara, Jim told me that Ann had seen a number of Suzuki's students. She told Suzuki she felt a little embarrassed about that and didn't want to interfere with his spiritual work. Suzuki told her, "You take care of their psychological aspect, and I'll take care of their spiritual aspect. Don't worry about it." Jim said that Suzuki was going to go see her, but he never got around to it. I'd say that he had no intention of doing so, that he wasn't interested in interpretive systems, psychics, psychologists, or astrologers. Suzuki summed it up when he said he was interested in astrology as a young man, that he came to feel that it wasn't necessary to know so much about oneself. Jim said that the Zen Center board had talked about their application and approved it on the condition that she not do any readings while at Tassajara. Later, Jim returned for a practice period outside of Tassajara and continued to do readings for a few people around the Zen Center, including the Bakers. The Buddhist Churches of America is the name of the Japanese Jodo Shin sect of Buddhism in the States. The San Francisco BCA temple was just around the corner from Sokoji on Octavia Street. Zen Center students frequented its unique Buddhist bookstore, and a few went there for services. Claude Dallenberg, principal among them. Kochin Ogui, a priest at the BCA temple, sometimes sat at Sokoji and had a close relationship with Suzuki. Sometimes Jodo Shinshu was likened to Christianity because of its devotional aspect. The founder, Shinran, attained enlightenment chanting the name of Amida Buddha. He parted with tradition by getting married and eating meat, and advocated the practice of thanking Amida Buddha that we're already enlightened. Ippo Shaku was a Jodo Shin priest. He came to Tassajara to check it out and visited with Suzuki. Years later, someone pointed him out to me walking on a path by the dining room and said he was a highly revered Jodo Shinshu elder. I showed him around and we hiked up to the Hogback to visit Suzuki's ashes site. Later, we sat down and drank tea. He told about his experience at the end of the war in Japan. He was on the outskirts of Hiroshima on the morning of August 6, 1945, when the atom bomb exploded. As soon as he recovered from the shock, he started walking. He walked and got rides on trucks and trains for 3 days and arrived at Nagasaki, 260 miles away in southern Kyushu, just before noon on August 9th. Maybe he went to Nagasaki because it's known as the Christian center of Japan. Maybe he thought it was safe there. At noon, the second atom bomb exploded there. After that, he struggled to survive and helped as he could when he could. He'd witnessed terrible suffering. He just told the story straight, no bitterness, no preaching. And he talked about Shunyu Suzuki. The first time I met him was at a New Year's celebration at Sokoji. I met a number of people there, and I was sitting next to Suzuki Roshi, and several members greeted me. Suzuki Roshi said, "You're so popular, you'd better take my place as abbot of this temple." Later, I visited him at Tassajara and asked, "What is the future of Buddhism in America?" He said he didn't know. I asked him if Americans could understand him. He said, "Whatever people understand is okay. By their free knowing, they will get it." I said, "Zazen is so uncomfortable for Westerners. Maybe there is some other way." He said, "That's all I know. That's what my teacher taught me." When he left Sokoji to start Zen Center on Page Street, one of the parishioners at a meeting said that all he did at Sokoji was nap. But he just calmly listened and was not disturbed. Suzuki Roshi had great character. He was never disturbed. His mind was very stable and calm. yet very flexible. Ruvain. It was not unusual for a young guy with a beard and ponytail to arrive at Tassajara, but that's where the usual ended with Ruvain. He came in with some students from the city. He wasn't expected. "Roshi told me I could come," he said. A call confirmed that Suzuki had given him the nod. But still, it wasn't kosher to come unannounced. He was adamant and articulate. Said if he wasn't accepted, he'd sit outside the gate in the cold. And it was cold. Winter interim. Deliberations among the officers. It was decided he had to go back to the city and then he could return right away, which he did. And went into a 3-day tangario the next day. It was so cold in the unheated Zendo that he had trouble getting up for service, like he'd been in a freezer and had to thaw out. After it was over and he was officially entered as a student, he went on and on about how great tangario was, what he'd learned about himself and the world and the cosmos. He said he owed it all to Meg, who'd sat there with him like a rock. He said that he'd not been sitting long, had practically not even heard of Buddhism until quite recently, and had only sat in the city a few days before finagling himself in. Suzuki had been ill with the flu, but had gotten up and walked to the corner grocery store. On his return, he was too weak to open the massive wood door to the temple. Ruvain had been watching from the steps of an apartment building across the street, ran over, opened the door for him, and introduced himself. A fast, garrulous talker with a New York City accent, Robert Front, had been making $119.66 an hour in New York as a Madison Avenue consultant. Got dissatisfied, wishing to know what it's all about, did what a lot of people did back then, turned to psychology, got dissatisfied with that, and left a PhD program in clinical psychology at the University of Montana. Just walked out. Never told them anything. Car broke down in the snow, way out beyond any services. Went to a farmhouse and knocked on the door. A naked man answered, introduced himself as Daniel Egink, and invited Front to join their commune. There were other naked people and guns. Front stuck around, gave himself a new name, Ruvain Ben-Human, which had roots in his family history. Egink had some big ideas. They had a TV studio in the house from which they could broadcast. We're planning on inviting 1,000 people to come build homes on the land. Then we're going to invite the Beatles and the Grateful Dead. International advertising had already started. On New Year's Eve, 1968, everyone took acid. Ruvain sat with Daniel and rapped about his spiritual quest. Daniel talked about Alan Watts and said he had a Zen teacher. He revered him so much, he'd stolen his teaching stick, but then returned it. He concluded with, "You want to meet this man?" He gave Ruvain $300 and put him on a plane to San Francisco. January 1st, 1969, Ruvain walked into Sokochi. He had two names of people to meet, Suzuki Roshi and Loring Palmer. At Tassajara, Ruvain couldn't persuade the authorities to let him stay for the practice period. Came back in April as soon as it was over, full of enthusiasm and with a shaved head. He threw himself into the schedule like a good student should, and then did as much as he possibly could in the breaks and cracks. He got into gardening right away, something he knew nothing about. Paul and Ruthie Disco loved his energy and gave him guidance. There was no limit to what he would take on. Paul suggested he make candles so he could stop buying them. There was resistance to the idea because people wanted proper-looking candles for the altars. Ruvain bought wax, molds, and wicks, and with Paul's advice was on his way to match store-bought quality. Suzuki heard about it and checked his work out, told him, "Remember, the important thing is the wicks must be in the center." "Of course," Ruvain replied, and appreciated Suzuki's smile in return. Ruvain had gotten to know Suzuki pretty well for the short time he'd been around. In the city, he had told Suzuki he wanted to be closer to his teacher, asked if he could move into Sokoji. Suzuki said that would make others jealous, but invited him to come at 4 a.m. so they could clean together. "We didn't talk, we just worked together," Ruvain said. "He always told me not to miss the dirt under the rug. We'd dust up and water the plants, and he'd put his eggshells in with the plants. He'd just leave them on top and water them, and the calcium would come off into the dirt. Smart. We had to make sure the zafus were positioned right on the zabutons and the zabutons in place. We'd vacuum sometimes, too." Ruvain said in a lecture in the city, Suzuki mentioned a trip to New York with Baker seeking support for the purchase of Tatsuhara, and he told us that he'd had a problem putting all those big buildings into his zazen. "I told Ruvain I'd heard him say that. It was hard for him to accept it all as part of his mind. But then I reminded him of that later, and he denied he'd ever said it." I said, "Oh no, I heard you," and he cut me off with the final, "I never said that." "Ah," he said, "of course. It was his way of telling you, you can't apply what he says across the board." About Suzuki's lectures, Ruvain said, "I can't remember what he said, but I feel good. It's that way with everyone. We remember a few phrases and everyone has different ideas about what he was saying, but everyone feels good, not only for the lecture, but for a few days. And people tend to feel like Suzuki was speaking directly to them," I said. "He was. He was speaking to me," Ruvain said. Ruvain said that in the city, we'd sit in the velvet seats in the pews downstairs for the Saturday lecture, and people would come in from the outside who weren't into Zen, and at the end they'd ask questions like, "When is the next earthquake coming?" And he'd say, "I don't know." Ruvain would take advice from Bill Shurtleff, who knew a lot about different diets. It was all new to Ruvain. Bill suggested he try macrobiotics, so Ruvain tried that, eating only whole grains. That wasn't hard to do at Tatsuhara. But then Bill suggested he try to eat just grapes for a while. Ruvain said he wasn't eating any grapes then, but he tried it, taking them from the Tatsuhara vines and ordering more on a town trip, and found it made him feel great. He got into other extreme food trips. Some got concerned he was going to become malnourished because he was only accepting food in the small third bowl in the zendo. But he grazed in the gardens, which were exploding with produce under his newly acquired green thumb. He would experiment further. For a while, he tried eating a teaspoon of garden dirt a day. After all, if it was good for the vegetables. The officers were concerned. He talked to Suzuki about how little he was eating, said he felt guilty not accepting the same as others, but that his meditation was better with this diet. Suzuki, who did not like food trips and was always encouraging us to practice together, once again was supportive of a renegade. Dogen always says, "Watch your own bowls," he said. For Dogen, what you're doing would not be a problem. Don't worry about it. You have to become yourself at some point. So what you're doing is not wrong according to Zen practice. It's maybe different, but no one should be disturbed by it. Everyone can eat what they need. But don't get sick. He quickly learned about the local plants, what could be eaten, what would make tea, and what could be smoked. I'd tried smoking yerba santa, which had a pleasant sedating effect before bed, most subtle. I wouldn't have even noticed the effect, except I was so pure from the Tassajara diet. Ruvain, however, after much trial, came up with a smoking mixture that was a real high, and there was no marijuana in it. I tried it once and liked it. Director Peter Schneider gently told Ruvain to cool it with the smokes, and Ruvain did. He tried a concoction of herbs and mushrooms to eat that someone else had come up with, got seriously ill, and passed out. When he came to, he heard the Han for Zazen sounding. Ruvain was determined to go, was slow, and met Suzuki on the bridge. Suzuki looked at him sternly and told him, "Never do that again." Ruvain wondered how Suzuki knew what had happened. Felt like he'd almost died and took Suzuki's command to heart. Roshi really loved Japanese eggplant, he said. I planted the regular and the Japanese as well, and he'd go through the garden and inspect them, and he was so excited about them. He'd look at them and talk about the shape. They're beautiful. He had a very high aesthetic. He had a love of nature and plants. He spent most of his time outside at Tassajara. He liked to work outside, and he liked to work. He said he'd look in the mirror and realize that he'd forgotten. He wasn't 20 years old. He was so childlike. He'd play with a student or find an interesting rock and get all excited. The kind of care and slowness with which he worked. He didn't want to create some big Zen garden. He was just moving rocks, no thought in mind. Just like he started Zen Center. Just start sitting, no big plan. Any big plan came from the students, not from him. Suzuki Roshi was so into stones, he'd go down to the stream and meditate on those stones for a while. He was greedy for stones. He even told me so. He'd look at the stones and think about them before we moved them up with the sled, if they were too big to carry. He would think of the stone he wanted before we'd get them, so it would take a while. Then he would plant the stone, plant it deep in the ground. This huge stone, sometimes only a little tiny bit would be above the ground, but he would know what was underneath. It's sort of like our Zen practice. I feel there is some teaching in his garden practice that you could apply to our Zen practice. Most of it you can't even see. I found Ruvain squatting in the garden one day as he worked. He said that a guest who'd lived in Asia had converted him, that this was the best way to sit, and that native people do it all over the world. I'd noticed how Japanese priests and students would not touch their knees to the ground if they had to work low. They'd squat. I envied them. Ruvain said it was also the best way to use the toilet. As a result of that conversation, I started squatting more, including on the toilet, and for several years would squat when using toilets and not on the seats. I'd put them up. I wonder why I stopped. It was good. I also wonder what Ruvane added to the compost. Ruvane tried new approaches in meditation. He said he'd spent a year meditating on the space between his thumbs and a year on his spine, and he had a lot of silent doksans with Suzuki. We'd just sit together. He might ask how I was doing and then just sitting. For a while, Ruvane had a girlfriend at Tassajara named Anna, who had gotten him into watching birds. She told him if you sit very quietly, the birds will come and be your friend. So day after lunch, he started going out near the compost pile and sitting on a big rock to wait for the birds to sit on him. For a few months, he tried to see how still he could become. The birds got close, but never perched on him. Still, he said, it was a terrific experience in which he'd sat so still he'd become a rock. One summer was extra hot and dry. The plants needed more water, even the drought-resistant ones on the hillside. Ruvane could see the trees were thirsty. So I started playing with an idea, and then I set up a time. And I said, 2 days from now at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, it's going to rain. I started working on it. I meditated on it and meditated on it and meditated on it. Then at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon of the appointed day, a roll of thunder. I thought, this is impossible. It never rains in the summertime. And there was a thunderstorm in the afternoon. I just went, wow. I went wild. And I went right away for Doksan. I was so excited. I thought, this is it. I'm enlightened. And I told Roshi what had happened, the whole story of what I'd done, that I'd meditated on rain and created a rainstorm to water the vegetables. And he started to hit me and yell at me, and he was real angry. He hit me many times, and he said that what I did was absolutely wrong. He said that if it rains here, it doesn't rain somewhere else. And how do you know where the rain should be? He said it was very selfish practice. I knew I had powers before that. Everyone has powers, different powers. And I was tempted to do things after that, but I never did. Another time he hit me because I did something wise-ass. And Suzuki Roshi started hitting me and said I had to get rid of the black snake. He was hitting me and hitting me with his stick. He was really hurting me. Suzuki, the officers, and a number of students would also not have been pleased at what went on at Tassajara one Christmas Eve. Almost everyone leaves for most of the winter interim. Those few who remained for this darkest and coldest of times happened to be a perfect selection for Loring to dig into a secret pouch and cook up what Ruvane described as a powerful batch of hash cookies. They were available in the afternoon. Ruvane said that before Christmas Eve dinner, they had a service to end all services. We chanted the Heart Sutra like it had never been chanted before. Bob Halpern and Barbara were there. Little thin Anna of the birds. We'd all been there for a year, and Loring and I thought we deserved to have those cookies. The chanting was like Tibetan chanting. We were just there and giving it our best energy. I think that service, more than anything at Tassajara, changed my consciousness. Ruvane's parents came to Tassajara. Roshi invited them to breakfast one morning. Ruvane was excited about the opportunity. I never had breakfast with him alone. My parents were freaked out about their good Jewish boy in this monastery, and now he'll never get married, right? And then they came out and they met Roshi and stayed a week and agreed with me. My father even sat in the zendo. Of course, Ruvane would bond with the most far-out people who drove or walked in to Tassajara. A weathered couple with tattered clothes who'd been living in the woods, surviving on wild plants. a wild-eyed visitor with news that the Beatles would be waiting for us on their secret island, a convincing crusader for the wonders of bamboo. There were rumors of a hunting cult whose goal was to eat the still throbbing heart and raw, warm liver of a deer they'd just downed. Ruvane got all excited about that and, with questionable intel based on the rumors, went out looking for them in vain. Most firmly planted in memory are three fellas we referred to as the Sheets. They came in a few times for the day, dressed in white sheets that they wore like sarongs. They'd go to the Narrows and the Baths. They ate only raw food, which they brought with them. Ruvane would join them as much as he could. We found them an interesting variation in the ebb and flow of guests. Then one day, they arrived in a helicopter, hovering over the... hovering over the garden first, waving to Ruvane, and then landing in the parking area above the front gate, where there was barely enough room for them to do so. One of them had just inherited a bunch of money, and they were on a mission to see how fast they could spend it. Ruvane flew off with them and returned in a few days with an odyssey of tales about what they'd done, including going to Vegas and the Grand Canyon, staying in fancy places, passing out money, buying gifts for friends and strangers. Okay, so that's a couple of pieces I'd written, thinking maybe they could be in Tassara Stories. Listen, I've got so much on Ruvane, I could do a whole book on him. And there's more about Ruvane coming up. And there's so much I've wondered, maybe I should do a book of, profiles of people and put him in there, because there's so much on him. He's like really dominant. He's cool there too. So we'll see what happens. I've been getting a lot of help from Wendy Piercing, and I appreciate that, because, there's all these parts, and that's the way Thank You and OK was, and that's the way Crooked Cucumber was. I spent 10 years on those two books, and had a lot of help, but I can't do that now. So we'll see. And also, I got a lot more I want to keep reading. I just want to read. That's fun. But we'll see what happens. I don't know. Okay. This has been a Cuke Audio podcast. I'm DC Poobah of Cuke Audio and Cuke Archives, coming to you from a sleepy Sonora with Doggett Bandita, Feline Cuchita, and dear, lovely Katrinka. We're wishing you and yours and all of us a grand awakening.